Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Für Volk und Führer, the memoir of a veteran of the 1st SS Panzer Division Leibstandarte SS Adolf Hitler, by Erwin Bartmann, translated and edited by Derek Hammond, narrated by James Foster. Introduction. My name is Erwin Walter Bartmann. My parents married on 14 February 1914, a romance that produced four sons. Tragedy visited their young lives when their firstborn, Hubert, died of a lung infection. My brother Horst was born in the summer of 1920, and little Heinz soon followed, but at the age of just 18 months, he too died and was buried beside Hubert in Schlochau's Waldfriedhof. As the youngest of the four boys, I only knew Heinz and Hubert through photographs and the wistful reminiscences of my mother. We left Schlochau in 1927 and moved to Berlin, where my parents rented a room from a Jewish family. Then my father, who had retired from the post office on medical grounds, came up with the idea of opening a fruit and vegetable business, and we moved to a tiny flat in Liebigstrasse where he set up shop. Every morning, with his squeaking handcart, he brought produce from the market hall on Alexanderplatz for mother to sell from a stall at the roadside. The business failed, compelling my father to abandon his dream of self-employment. To make ends meet, he took a job in a grocer's shop on Lichtenberger Strasse and, just as he had done when he had had his own business, set off early each morning for the same market hall on Alexanderplatz to load up a cart with fruit and vegetables. Eventually, he saved enough money to enable us to rent a two-roomed flat at 38 Strausberger Strasse, in the Friedrichshain district and a little closer to the city center. An iron stairway, its handrails worn thin and brown, led to our new flat, which shared a toilet in the stairwell with three other families, including a Jewish family who lived next door on the same landing. There were two girls in this family, one about my age and the other a little older. By the end of 1929, my father lost his job. To supplement our meager family income, my mother, a seamstress by profession, made blouses for well-to-do ladies and scrubbed the stairs of the apartment block to earn a reduction in rent. I attended the local Volksschule, which lay almost directly across the street from our flat. From the outset, Herr Werth, the headmaster, was my class teacher. A small man with a great love of music, he told us of his boyhood ambition of becoming a musician and encouraged us not to repeat his mistake. "Always follow your dream," he advised. He was eternally cheerful and helpful to his pupils, characteristics that made it impossible for me not to hold him in high regard. During his frequent departures to attend to official duties in his office, the presence of volunteers, aunts or mothers of fellow pupils, and the promise of corporal punishment for any boy who overstepped the bounds of acceptable behavior, maintained class discipline. Hitler came to power shortly after my 9th birthday. As I grew into my teenage years, I watched with admiration Hitler's personal guard, the Leibstandarte, parade the streets of Berlin. Immaculate in their black uniforms and shining helmets, their ranks marched in precise step, a sight that made my boyish heart race with pride. In the streets, in the media, the voice of the German people rang with optimism. Everyone around me was happy. A rising mood of confidence overwhelmed my world, and I felt secure, valued. As a young Berliner, too young to have an interest in politics, what could be more honorable than aspiring to join the elite, the Leibstandarte SS Adolf Hitler? That the situation was not as idyllic as it appeared was something I had yet to learn. This is neither a tale of the mechanisms of war nor of great strategic maneuvers. This is my story. Memoirs from my youth and the time I served as a soldier of the Leibstandarte. The events I describe are those experienced from my own perspective as an ordinary soldier. With pride, naive pride perhaps, I took my oath to Hitler and swore Gehorsam bis in den Tod, obedience unto death. Most of those I write about are now long dead, Kameraden upon whom my life once depended, officers who won the devotion of their men and townspeople and farmers of the lands we occupied in our fight against Bolshevism. In a very few instances, I have taken the liberty of changing a name to protect the identity of an individual. The reader should also bear in mind that the dates I give for particular episodes in my life at the Ostfront, unless they relate to some personally significant event like a birthday or anniversary or a high point in the calendar, are either approximate or taken from reliable published works, such as Rudolf Lehmann's series The Leibstandarte. An ordinary soldier of the Leibstandarte was not permitted to keep a diary that an enemy might use to gain useful intelligence. Furthermore, keeping a record might well have brought accusations of spying. At the age of 88 years, I am, in the words of the song of our pioneer corps, zur Himmelstür, at heaven's door. I have nothing to gain by misrepresenting the truth. My aim is simple: to give the reader an insight into the life of a boy who grew up to become a soldier in Hitler's elite division, the Leibstandarte SS Adolf Hitler. 1. A Diary of Indoctrination. Saturday, March 1st, 1930. A chill mist saturated the air over Berlin, but even the worst weather could not dampen my father's passion for walking. "Are we going to the park, Vati?" I asked, breaking into little runs to keep pace. "Not today, Erwin. There's something I want to show you." Two left turns took us into Lichtenberger Strasse, where we stopped close to the open door of a public house. "In there," said Father, crouching by my side, his lips close to my ear. "That's where Horst Wessel held his political meetings, his Sturmlokal." "Who was Horst Wessel?" "A hero of the German folk, Erwin. A national socialist, a young man who gave everything for his beliefs, just like Jesus, until a communist swine knocked on his door and shot off his jaw." We continued towards the center of Berlin, adding to the steady stream of humanity making its way towards Berlauplatz and voices singing the communist anthem Die Internationale. "That's a nice tune, Vati." "There's nothing nice about communism, son." As we emerged onto Berlauplatz, overlooked by slogans written in enormous letters hanging on the walls of the Communist Party building, the singing gave way to a contest of poisonous shouts and jeers between opposing factions. "What's happening, Vati?" Father raised his voice to make himself heard above the clamor. "It's the day of Wessel's funeral. I didn't expect things to be so rowdy. There was supposed to be a ban on crowds and flags. These communist thugs are here to cause trouble." Across the street, police wearing shiny black leather helmets struggled to keep opposing factions at bay as the cortege, led by a troop of bandsmen playing funereal music, approached. "Vati, who are the men in brown shirts?"
"A guard of honor, Erwin. Hitler's Sturmabteilung men, the SA. I wish these communist idiots would shut up so we could hear the music."
A hearse pulled by horses draped with black mantles and black plumes on their heads followed the ranks of the SA men. Suddenly, stones ripped up from the pavements showered the cortege. Women screamed in horror as demonstrators burst through the police cordon to grapple with the SA men in an attempt to seize the coffin. Police cavalry, batons flailing, launched into the mob. Tires screeched as armored cars sped up and down the street. I cowered in a doorway behind Father until the police restored order. "Now, son, you see just what sort of people these communists are. Traitors and hooligans bringing endless disruption to our streets. They won't be content until they ruin everyone's life." Although I was only 6 years old at the time of Horst Wessel's funeral, I can recall the events of that day with absolute clarity. Fear had burned the images of chaos on the streets of Berlin deep into my memory. Summer, 1930. On our way home from Friedrichshain, a park close to our flat, we took a little detour to join the crowds lining the pavements on Palisadenstrasse. Onlookers craned their necks or stood on tiptoes to get a better view as a detachment of SA singing Die Fahne hoch
Raise Up the Flag, approached. Horst Wessel had written the words of this song, which, set to a traditional folk tune, was now a Nazi anthem. "We'll hang on a bit," said Father, "but make sure you don't drop your ball. We don't want it to spoil the parade." Across the road, a woman who lived in the flat above ours stood at the edge of the pavement. As the SA parade drew near, I waved to attract her attention. She returned my greeting, then, to my astonishment, turned her back and pulled up her skirt. Shrieks of laughter spilled from the spectators as she dropped her knickers and bent over to expose her bottom, and everything else a woman should keep private. This was a bad mistake. The woman struggled hopelessly as two well-built SA men grabbed her arms while their colleagues took turns at delivering hard slaps to the exposed flesh, which rapidly turned fiery red. "She was asking for that," said Father. A few days after this incident, the woman, an avowed communist, dropped into our flat to show my mother the purple imprints left by SA hands. Monday, January 30th, 1933. Hitler, appointed Reichskanzler by President Paul von Hindenburg, took control of Germany. That evening I stood with my parents and brother Horst on Unter den Linden at the corner of Wilhelmstrasse to witness the torchlight procession pass through the Brandenburg Gate on its way from the Tiergarten to the Reichskanzlei, now Hitler's official residence. The whole thing started late in the evening and went on until the early hours of the next day. Though it was still deep in winter time, I cannot recall feeling cold, as the SA and war veterans, members of the right-wing Stahlhelm organization, paraded their colorful standards. Behind them marched a column of massed torchbearers and bands playing military marches. Every onlooker wore a broad smile. Police lining the pavements laughed as they joined hands to push with their backs against an enthusiastic surge of the crowd. Waves of sound rose up, waves that swelled in my ears until I could hear nothing else. "Heil! Heil! Heil!" Her gray-blue eyes glistening in the light from the torches, my mother turned her gaze from the parade to look at me. She smiled as she squeezed my hand. I returned her squeeze, her smile, to tell her that I, too, had felt the power of the moment. Together we held our right arms aloft and added our voices to the chant, "Heil! Heil!" After the parade, we joined the jubilant onlookers gathered in Wilhelmplatz, directly in front of the Reichskanzlei, to shout ourselves hoarse with the chant, "Wir wollen unseren Führer sehen!" We want to see our leader. Hitler appeared at a floodlit window on the first floor. There was no balcony on the Reichskanzlei at that time, to acknowledge the adulation of his folk, with his right hand flung back in the salute that was to become his hallmark. It seemed the mood for the city had changed for the better. For the first time, it was safe to play in the streets without the threat of violence throwing the whole district into disorder. Everyday life settled into an orderly, industrious routine. I was, of course, oblivious to the news that Himmler had announced the need for concentration camps throughout the Reich for the Beruhigung der nationalen Bevölkerung, reassurance of the people. What did I care if the prisoners were Marxists, common criminals, or homosexuals? Who could have foreseen, let alone a 9-year-old boy, that this was the first stepping stone to the horrors of the extermination camps? Spring, 1934. As Hitler's fortunes blossomed, there appeared on the streets boys smartly dressed in shorts and shirts. Some rode bicycles carrying handwritten notices on cardboard tied to the handlebars, urging others to join them. Hinein ins Jungvolk. Word soon spread that these boys, members of the Deutsche Jungvolk, DJ, enjoyed trips to the cinema and weekend camps. Before long, most of the boys over 10 in my class had joined, some of whom were former members of the Sozialistische Arbeitjugend, SAJ, the left-wing equivalent of the DJ. In many ways, these two organizations offered similar pursuits, but the DJ was better organized and, unlike the SAJ, which was predominantly a working-class organization, included boys from all strata of society, from Volksschule and Gymnasium. Social class was no longer a barrier to Kameradschaft, a manifestation of the chant that had now become familiar to me, Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. One people, one nation, one leader. My parents wholeheartedly approved of my enlistment in the DJ. It's better for the youth to be well organized than hang around street corners, they said. One of the first things that struck me when I joined, at that time membership was voluntary, was that I was granted a degree of freedom and trust that made me feel grown up and responsible for my own actions. In general, it was older boys in the organizations who acted as instructors. Youth itself was valued, a thing of beauty. Summer weekends were great adventures spent camping in the forests around Berlin. Fluttering above the camp was always the flag of the DJ, which carried, like a bolt of lightning in startling white against a black ground, the angular Sigrun, the runic S, symbol of victory. I always looked forward to the Battle of the Flags, my favorite activity at the DJ camps. This was a competition between rival DJ groups, often from different parts of Berlin. The object of this contest was quite simple: to capture the rival's flag. But to carry out such a seemingly simple objective required considerable strategic planning. Was it better to leave the biggest and strongest boys to guard the banner? Should they lead the raid on our rivals, and who among us were emerging as leaders? I'm sure the instructors looked out for such things, but as far as I was concerned, the fun was in the sheer physical activity of the game, which could, and usually did, get quite rough. Often I arrived home on a Sunday evening with bruises, marks of honor proudly displayed to my parents as proof that I had done my bit for my Kameraden. Through my adolescent eyes, such events appeared to be nothing more than vigorous sporting activity. There was never any training with weapons, so it never occurred to me that this was preparation for life in the military. Drums, flags, and marching were our constant companions in the DJ, but my head knew nothing of my legs as we trooped tirelessly along sunlit country lanes and through villages where admiring onlookers watched us pass. We sang with happy voices, Die Fahne flattert uns voran, the flag leads us forward. That the path I marched so joyously could lead to the destruction of all that I held dear was a concept too distant for my imagination. One can read nowadays that the youth of Germany was brutalized by their membership of the DJ. It is true that the activities in the DJ helped develop strength, discipline, loyalty, and obedience, that we learned respect for women and to be prepared to die for our country. But these were exactly the same attributes and attitudes described by Baden-Powell in his book Scouting for Boys, published in 1909, which placed the ordinary boy at the center of Britain's empire, a sign of the times in which we lived. Everything we did as members of the DJ was approved by our parents and by the Reich that Germans had yearned for, the Reich that found a place for every true German. Our parents were members of Hitler's party, the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, NSDAP, Nazis, or the Nazi Trade Organization, the Deutsche Arbeitsfront, DAF, or both. Encouraged by the authorities, our mothers performed good social deeds for the benefit of the community. My own mother stitched the flags that decorated the bugles of my DJ unit as she hummed traditional folk melodies. Once a month, on a Sunday, my father collected the Eintopf contributions, money saved by each family by preparing a stew from leftovers and donated to the Nazi party from the residents of the flats at 38 Strausberger Straße. We, the youth of the DJ, were simply another piece of the jigsaw. Summer, 1936. In Berlin's streets and parks, the brash English of rich Americans mingled with the rise and fall of animated Italian. In shops, the delectable scent of beautiful French women lingered long after they had left. Flamboyant color spilled from flower baskets hanging from every lamp standard and balcony in the sunny streets of central Berlin. Long scarlet banners with black swastikas inside white circles adorned public buildings. Berlin was exciting, pulsating with life as my brother Horst and I made our way to the Neue Wache, the classically styled building dedicated to the memory of German soldiers who had made the ultimate sacrifice during the Great War. "Hey, you kids, what do you think you're playing at?" Ignoring the complaints, Horst pushed me through the crowd of tourists gathered to watch the changing of the guard. With my brother's hands resting protectively on my shoulders, I gazed in wonder at the three approaching Leibstandarte men. Dressed in immaculate black uniforms and wearing belts and gloves of purest white, they were an awe-inspiring sight. A tourist next to me looked at his pocket watch, nodded in approval, and declared, "Exactly on time." Stopping only a few meters from our vantage point, the Leibstandarte men turned smartly and marched up to the two guards, waiting to be relieved of their watch. With perfect precision, a seamless and, to my young eyes, fascinatingly complex interchange of personnel took place. "Horst, do you think I could join the Leibstandarte one day? They only take you if you are very tall, and you need to pass a strict medical examination. Do you think I would pass the medical?" "I doubt it, Ervi. The scars from your appendix operation still haven't healed completely. You even missed school swimming lessons." He patted my shoulder. "The Leibstandarte accepts only the tallest and fittest men." On the day of the Olympic Games opening ceremony, as I traveled across Berlin with other pupils from my class, part of the massed choir of 3,000 drawn from Berlin schools, I was looking forward to making my contribution to the important historical event. We took our places in the magnificent new stadium, on the opposite side of the arena from which Hitler would declare the opening of the games from a private balcony. At key points, camera crews prepared to transmit the world's first live television pictures of a major sporting event. As 4 p.m. drew near, trumpeters on the great stone pedestals either side of the marathon gate played a fanfare. The excited clamor of 100,000 voices faded to a diffuse murmur. At precisely 4 p.m., Hitler entered the stadium to tumultuous applause. Everyone stood to get a better view of the Führer. Even foreign visitors, as if compelled by the same invisible force that governed us Germans, raised their right arms in the Nazi salute. A girl, 6 or 7 years of age, and wearing a white summer dress, stood on the running track, her sun-browned arm held high in salute as Hitler approached. In her left hand, she grasped a bunch of flowers. As Hitler bent to accept the bouquet, the girl made a nervous curtsy. Then, to the rousing melodies of the Deutschlandlied and Die Fahne hoch, Hitler and his guests settled into their places on the private balcony. A brief stillness fell across the stadium before a voice on the PA system called out, "Hiest Flagge!" And on the high rim of the stadium, the flags of the gathered nations were hoisted to the majestic peal of the specially cast Olympic bell. Like a call to prayer, it seemed to demand submission to the cause of a greater will. In reaffirmation of our loyalty, we responded devoutly, "Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!" until, resonating within the confines of the stadium, the words merged into a chorus of adulation for our Führer. One after the other, in a gloriously colorful procession, the national teams paraded on the running track to the sound of stirring Prussian march music. A standard-bearer led the sportsmen and women of each participating nation, dipping his flag as he drew opposite the balcony where Hitler stood, except for the Americans, whose flag remained held high and whose team members, instead of saluting, took off their straw hats and held them over their hearts. This apparent act of defiance displeased the crowd, whose cheers abruptly turned to disapproving mumbles. After a speech by the president of the Olympic Committee, Hitler duly declared the games open. A gun salute fired by an artillery unit of the Wehrmacht signaled the release of thousands of doves that circled above the Marathon Gate before disappearing into the summer blue sky, a symbol of peace that belied the tumult soon to shatter much of Europe and change my life forever. The massed choir sang Richard Strauss's Olympic anthem, and I too sang with all my heart, proud to be a young German. An air of expectation fell upon the crowd with every eye fastened on the steps at the main entrance to witness what would become an Olympic tradition. Fritz Schilgen, a popular German athlete, a model of Aryan manhood, appeared holding aloft the Olympic torch. Saluted by officials dressed in white, Schilgen descended the steps to the running track. His elegant stride carried him past the Führer's balcony, onwards to the steps that led to the receptacle of fire above the Marathon Gate at the western end of the elliptical stadium. On reaching the cauldron, Schilgen presented the white magnesium flame of the Olympic torch to the crowd. Overcome by the spectacular nature of the ceremony, we sat open-mouthed and silent. As Schilgen lowered the torch to ignite the flame that would burn for the duration of the games, the expectant hush gave way to the ecstatic applause of the onlookers. Silence once more descended on the stadium as German weightlifting champion Rudolf Ismayr grabbed the corner of the Olympic flag to take the Olympic oath, an act that brought to mind the oath of the Teutonic Knights that I had learned about at school. Then, to the glorious refrain of Handel's Hallelujah, the teams left through the marathon tunnel, the conclusion to an Olympic Games opening ceremony so perfect it would form the prototype for those that followed. That day will remain in my memory until I die. As I left the stadium, it was easy to believe I was living in the best country in the world. Without realizing it, I had surrendered to the zeitgeist cultivated by the Führer. At the cost of around 2 to 5 Reichsmarks, tickets were too expensive for our family to attend the Olympic Games in person, but television parlors, Germany had the world's first public television broadcasting service, had been prepared in various locations throughout Berlin with entry by free ticket. As soon as he heard the tickets were available, my father set off for the post office in Palisadenstrasse, where the viewing parlor closest to our flat had been set up. "There's a problem," father said with a concerned look on his face when he returned to our flat. "I only managed to get 3 tickets, and they're only allowing viewers over the age of 14. "I'll look after Ervi," offered mother. "You can go with Horst."
"No, wait here, Papa." I had an idea and disappeared into my parents' bedroom. When I returned, I was wearing a pair of my brother's long trousers. Mother laughed.
"Ervi, you'll never get in dressed like that."
"It's worth a try," offered Horst. "He's tall for his age."
When we reached the door of the post office, an official with a silver beard and mustache took the ticket from my hand and bent forward to look me in the eye. Then, with a wry smile, he nodded his head and tousled my hair with a big, rough hand that smelled of fresh tobacco. Led by the flow of the crowd, we came to a darkened room where a television receiver perched on a shelf high up on the wall. We waited in silence as a technician stood on a stool to adjust the control knobs. A collective gasp rose up as images from the Olympic Stadium formed. And my father declared, "What wonders Hitler has given the German people." 2. The Apprentice. During my last year at school, twice a week, the first lesson took place in the parish hall of the Evangelical Church of the Resurrection, where we studied the Bible in preparation for our confirmation ceremony in March 1938. With about 20 other students, I became a registered member of the congregation that my father served as an elder. At the end of the month, I left school to take my place in the world of work. "It was good enough for your grandfather," declared Mutti as she bent over the kitchen sink, "so it's good enough for you."
but I liked working with wood when I was at school. I was good at it, I protested. Horst's a carpenter, and if that's good enough for him... Mutti turned from her dishes, her chapped wet knuckles on her hips in the manner of a Russian folk dancer. That's enough.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?